In the space of 11 years, that hero fought in person 14 battles, and such was his activity that he led his cavalry in 17 days from Tephlia to Kermon, a march of 1,000 miles. Yet he was oppressed by the jealousy of the Muslim princes and the innumerable armies of the Moguls, and after his last defeat, Gilal ad-Din perished ignobly in the mountains of Kurdistan. His death dissolved a veteran and adventurous army, which included under the name of Khwarizmians or Khorasmins, many Turkman hordes that had attached themselves to the Sultan's fortune. The bolder and more powerful chiefs invaded Syria and violated the Holy Sepulchre of Jerusalem. The more humble engaged in the service of Aladdin, Sultan of Iconium, and among these were the obscure fathers of the Ottoman line. They had formerly pitched their tents near the southern banks of the Oxus and the plains of Mahan and Nessa, and it is somewhat remarkable that the same spot should have produced the first authors of the Parthian and Turkish empires. At the head or in the rear of a Khwarizmian army, Suleiman Shah was drowned in the passage of the Euphrates. His son, Orthogrul, became the soldier and subject of Aladdin, and established at Surgut, on the banks of the Sangar, a camp of 400 families or tents, whom he governed 52 years, both in peace and war. He was the father of Thaman, or Athman, whose Turkish name has been melted into the appellation of the Caliph Uthman. And if we describe that pastoral chief as a shepherd and a robber, we must separate from those characters all idea of ignominy and baseness. Uthman possessed and perhaps surpassed the ordinary virtues of a soldier, and the circumstances of time and place were propitious to his independence and success. The Seljukian dynasty was no more, and the distance and decline of the Mughal Khans soon enfranchised him from the control of a superior. He was situated on the verge of the Greek Empire. The Quran sanctified his Ghazi, or holy war, against the infidels, and their political errors unlocked the passes of Mount Olympus and invited him to descend into the plains of Bithynia. Till the reign of Palaeologus, these passes had been vigilantly guarded by the militia of the country, who were repaid by their own safety and an exemption from taxes. The emperor abolished their privilege and assumed their office, but the tribute was rigorously collected, the custody of the passes was neglected, and the hardy mountaineers degenerated into a trembling crowd of peasants without spirit or discipline. It was on the 27th of July, in the year 1299 of the Christian era, that Uthman first invaded the territory of Nicomedia, and the singular accuracy of the date seems to disclose some foresight of the rapid and destructive growth of the monster. The annals of the 27 years of his reign would exhibit a repetition of the same inroads, and his hereditary troops were multiplied in each campaign by the accession of captives and volunteers. Instead of retreating to the hills, he maintained the most useful and defensive posts, fortified the towns and castles which he had first pillaged, and renounced the pastoral life of the baths and palaces of his infant capitals. But it was not till Uthman was oppressed by age and infirmities that he received the welcome news of the conquest of Prusa, which had been surrendered by famine or treachery to the arms of his son Orkan. The glory of Uthman is chiefly founded on that of his descendants, but the Turks have transcribed or composed a royal testament of his last counsels of justice and moderation. From the conquest of Prusa we may date the true era of the Ottoman Empire. The lives and possessions of the Christian subjects were redeemed by tribute or ransom of 30,000 crowns of gold, and the city, by the labors of Orkan, assumed the aspect of a Mohammedan capital. Prusa was decorated with a mosque, a college, and a hospital of royal foundation. The Seljukian coin was changed for the name and impression of the new dynasty, and the most skillful professors of human and divine knowledge attracted the Persian and Arabian students from the ancient schools of Oriental learning. The office of vizier was instituted for Aladdin, the brother of Orkan, and a different habit distinguished the citizens from the peasants, the Muslims from the infidels. All the troops of Othman had consisted of loose squadrons of Turkmen cavalry, who served without pay and fought without discipline. But a regular body of infantry was first established and trained by the prudence of his son. A great number of volunteers was enrolled with a small stipend, but with the permission of living at home unless they were summoned to the field. Their rude manners and seditious temper disposed Orkan to educate his young captives as his soldiers and those of the Prophet. But the Turkish peasants were still allowed to mount on horseback and follow his standard with the appellation and the hopes of freebooters. By these arts he formed an army of 25,000 Muslims. A train of battering engines was framed for the use of sieges, and the first successful experiment was made on the cities of Nice and Nicomedia. Orkan granted a safe conduct to all who were desirous of departing with their families and effects, but the widows of the slain were given in marriage to the conquerors, and the sacrilegious plunder, the books, the vases, and the images were sold or ransomed at Constantinople. The Emperor Andronicus the Younger was vanquished and wounded by the son of Othman. He subdued the whole province or kingdom of Bithynia as far as the shores of the Bosphorus and Hellespont, and the Christians confessed the justice and clemency of a reign which claimed the voluntary attachment of the Turks of Asia. Yet Orkan was content with the modest title of Emir, and in the list of his compeers, the princes of Rum or Anatolia, his military forces were surpassed by the emirs of Germion and Karamania, each of which could bring into the field an army of 40,000 men. Their domains were situated in the heart of the Seljukian kingdom, but the holy warriors, though of inferior note, who formed new principalities on the Greek Empire, are more conspicuous in the light of history. The maritime country, from the Propontis to the Meander and the Isle of Rhodes, so long threatened and so often pillaged, was finally lost about the 13th year of Andronicus the Elder. Two Turkish chieftains, Sarukan and Aydin, left their names to their conquests and their conquests to their posterity. The captivity or ruin of the seven churches of Asia was consummated, and the barbarous lords of Ionia and Lydia still trample on the monuments of classic and Christian antiquity. In the loss of Ephesus, the Christians deplored the fall of the first angel, the extinction of the first candlestick of the Revelations. The desolation is complete, and the Temple of Diana or the Church of Mary will equally elude the search of the curious traveller. The circus and three stately theatres of Laodicea are now peopled with wolves and foxes. Sardis is reduced to a miserable village. The god of Muhammad, without a rival or a son, is invoked in the mosques of Thyatira and Pergamos. And the populousness of Smyrna is supported by the foreign trade of the Franks and Armenians. Philadelphia alone has been saved by prophecy or courage. At a distance from the sea, forgotten by the emperors, encompassed on all sides by the Turks, her valiant citizens defended their religion and freedom above 80 years, and at length capitulated with the proudest of the Ottomans. Among the Greek colonies and churches of Asia, Philadelphia is still erect, a column in a scene of ruins. A pleasing example that the paths of honor and safety may sometimes be the same. The servitude of Rhodes was delayed about 2 centuries by the establishment of the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem. Under the discipline of the order, that island emerged into fame and opulence. The noble and warlike monks were renowned by land and sea, and the bulwark of Christendom provoked and repelled the arms of the Turks and Saracens. The Greeks, by their intestine divisions, were the authors of their final ruin. During the civil wars of the elder and younger Andronicus, the son of Othman achieved, almost without resistance, the conquest of Bithynia, and the same disorders encouraged the Turkish emirs of Lydia and Ionia to build a fleet and to pillage the adjacent islands and the seacoast of Europe. In the defense of his life and honor, Cantacuzini was tempted to prevent or imitate his adversaries by calling to his aid the public enemies of his religion and country. Amir, the son of Aydin, concealed under a Turkish garb the humanity and politeness of a Greek. He was united with the great domestic by mutual esteem and reciprocal services, and their friendship is compared, in the vain rhetoric of the times, to the perfect union of Orestes and Pylades. On the report of the danger of his friend, who was persecuted by an ungrateful court, the Prince of Ionia assembled at Smyrna a fleet of 300 vessels, with an army of 29,000 men, sailed in the depth of winter, and cast anchor at the mouth of the Hebrus. From thence, with a chosen band of 2,000 Turks, he marched along the banks of the river and rescued the Empress, who was besieged in Demotica by the wild Bulgarians. At that disastrous moment, the life or death of his beloved Cantacuzini was concealed by his flight into Serbia. But the grateful Irene, impatient to behold her deliverer, invited him to enter the city, and accompanied her message with a present of rich apparel and 100 horses. By a peculiar strain of delicacy, the gentle barbarian refused, in the absence of an unfortunate friend, to visit his wife or to taste the luxuries of the palace. Sustained in his tent the rigor of the winter, and rejected the hospitable gift that he might share the hardships of 2,000 companions, all as deserving as himself of that honor and distinction. Necessity and revenge might justify his predatory excursions by sea and land. He left 9,500 men for the guard of his fleet, and persevered in the fruitless search of Cantacuzini, till his embarkation was hastened by a fictitious letter, the severity of the season, the clamors of his independent troops, and the weight of his spoil and captives. In the prosecution of the civil war, the Prince of Ionia twice returned to Europe, joined his arms with those of the Emperor, besieged Thessalonica, and threatened Constantinople. Calumny might affix some reproach on his imperfect aid, his hasty departure, and a bribe of 10,000 crowns which he accepted from the Byzantine court. But his friend was satisfied, and the conduct of Amir is excused by the more sacred duty of defending against the Latins his hereditary dominions. The maritime power of the Turks had united the Pope, the King of Cyprus, the Republic of Venice, and the Order of St. John in a laudable crusade. Their galleys invaded the coast of Ionia, and Amir was slain with an arrow in the attempt to wrest from the Rhodian knights the citadel of Smyrna. Before his death he generously recommended another ally of his own nation, not more sincere or zealous than himself, but more able to afford a prompt and powerful succor by his situation along the Propontis and in the front of Constantinople. By the prospect of a more advantageous treaty, the Turkish prince of Bithynia was detached from his engagements with Anne of Savoy, and the pride of Orkan dictated the most solemn protestations that if he could obtain the daughter of Cantacuzini, he would invariably fulfill the duties of a subject and a son. Parental tenderness was silenced by the voice of ambition. The Greek clergy connived at the marriage of a Christian princess with a sectary of Mohammed, and the father of Theodora describes with shameful satisfaction the dishonor of the purple. A body of Turkish cavalry attended the ambassadors, who disembarked from 30 vessels before his camp of Celebria. A stately pavilion was erected, in which the Empress Irene passed the night with her daughters. In the morning Theodora ascended a throne, which was surrounded with curtains of silk and gold. The troops were under arms, but the emperor alone was on horseback. At a signal, the curtains were suddenly withdrawn to disclose the bride or the victim, encircled by kneeling eunuchs and hymeneal torches. The sound of flutes and trumpets proclaimed the joyful event, and her pretended happiness was the theme of the nuptial song, which was chanted by such poets as the age could produce. Without the rites of the church, Theodora was delivered to her barbarous lord, but it had been stipulated that she should preserve her religion in the harem of Bursa, and her father celebrates her charity and devotion in this ambiguous situation. After his peaceful establishment on the throne of Constantinople, the Greek emperor visited his Turkish ally, who with four sons by various wives expected him at Scutari on the Asiatic shore. The two princes partook with seeming cordiality of the pleasures of the banquet and the chase, and Theodora was permitted to repass the Bosphorus and to enjoy some days in the society of her mother. But the friendship of Orkan was subservient to his religion and interest, and in the Genoese war he joined without a blush the enemies of Cantacuzini. In the treaty with the Empress Anne, the Ottoman prince had inserted a singular condition, that it should be lawful for him to sell his prisoners at Constantinople or transport them into Asia. A naked crowd of Christians of both sexes and every age, of priests and monks, of matrons and virgins, was exposed in the public market. The whip was frequently used to quicken the charity of redemption, and the indigent Greeks deplored the fate of their brethren, who were led away to the worst evils of temporal and spiritual bondage. Cantacuzini was reduced to subscribe the same terms, and their execution must have been still more pernicious to the empire. A body of 10,000 Turks had been detached to the assistance of the Empress Anne, but the entire forces of Orkan were exerted in the service of his father. Yet these calamities were of a transient nature. As soon as the storm had passed away, the fugitives might return to their habitations, and at the conclusion of the civil and foreign wars, Europe was completely evacuated by the Muslims of Asia. It was in his last quarrel with his pupil that Cantacuzini inflicted the deep and deadly wound which could never be healed by his successors, and which is poorly expiated by his theological dialogues against the Prophet Muhammad. Ignorant of their own history, the modern Turks confound their first and their final passage of the Hellespont, and describe the son of Orkan as a nocturnal robber who, with 80 companions, explores by stratagem a hostile and unknown shore. Suleiman, at the head of 10,000 horse, was transported in the vessels and entertained as the friend of the Greek emperor. In the civil wars of Romania, he performed some service and perpetrated more mischief, but the Chersonesus was insensibly filled with a Turkish colony, and the Byzantine court solicited in vain the restitution of the fortresses of Thrace. After some artful delays between the Ottoman prince and his son, their ransom was valued at 60,000 crowns, and the first payment had been made when an earthquake shook the walls and cities of the provinces. The dismantled palaces were occupied by the Turks, and Gallipoli, the key of the Hellespont, was rebuilt and repeopled by the policy of Suleiman. The abdication of Cantacuzini dissolved the feeble bands of domestic alliance, and his last advice admonished his countrymen to decline a rash contest, and to compare their own weakness with the numbers and valor, the discipline and enthusiasm of the Muslims. His prudent counsels were despised by the headstrong vanity of youth, and soon justified by the victories of the Ottomans. But as he practiced in the field the exercise of the jerid, Suleiman was killed by a fall from his horse, and the aged Orkan wept and expired on the tomb of his valiant son. But the Greeks had not time to rejoice in the death of their enemies. Then the Turkish scimitar was wielded with the same spirit by Amirath the First, the son of Orkhan, and the brother of Suleiman. By the pale and fainting light of the Byzantine annals, we can discern that he subdued without resistance the whole province of Romania or Thrace, from the Hellespont to Mount Hemus, and the verge of the capital, and that Adrianople was chosen for the royal seat of his government and religion in Europe. Constantinople, whose decline is almost coeval with her foundation, had often in the lapse of 1,000 years been assaulted by the barbarians of the east and west. But never till this fatal hour had the Greeks been surrounded, both in Asia and Europe, by the arms of the same hostile monarchy. Yet the prudence or generosity of Amurath postponed for a while this easy conquest, and his pride was satisfied with the frequent and humble attendance of the emperor John Palaeologus and his four sons, who followed at his summons the court and camp of the Ottoman prince. He marched against the Sclavonian nations between the Danube and the Adriatic, the Bulgarians, Serbians, Bosnians, and Albanians. And these warlike tribes, who had so often insulted the majesty of the empire, were repeatedly broken by his destructive inroads. Their countries did not abound either in gold or silver, nor were their rustic hamlets and townships enriched by commerce or decorated by the arts of luxury. But the natives of the soil have been distinguished in every age by their hardiness of mind and body, and they were converted by a prudent institution into the firmest and most faithful supporters of the Ottoman greatness. The vizier of Amurath reminded his sovereign that, according to the Mohammedan law, he was entitled to a fifth part of the spoil and captives, and that the duty might easily be levied if vigilant officers were stationed in Gallipoli to watch the passage and to select for his use the stoutest and most beautiful of the Christian youth. The advice was followed. The edict was proclaimed. Many thousands of the European captives were educated in religion and arms, and the new militia was consecrated and named by celebrated dervis. Standing in the front of their ranks, he stretched the sleeve of his gown over the head of the foremost soldier, and his blessing was delivered in these words: "Let them be called Janissaries, Cengi Ciri, or new soldiers. May their countenance be ever bright, their hand victorious, their sword keen. May their spear always hang over the heads of their enemies, and wheresoever they go, may they return with a white face." Such was the origin of these haughty troops, the terror of the nations and sometimes of the sultans themselves. Their valor has declined, their discipline is relaxed, and their tumultuary array is incapable of contending with the order and weapons of modern tactics. But at the time of their institution, they possessed a decisive superiority in war. Since a regular body of infantry in constant exercise and pay was not maintained by any of the princes of Christendom, the Janissaries fought with the zeal of proselytes against their idolatrous countrymen, and in the Battle of Kosovo, the league and independence of the Sclavonian tribes was finally crushed. As the conqueror walked over the field, he observed that the greatest part of the slain consisted of beardless youths, and listened to the flattering reply of his vizier that age and wisdom would have taught them not to oppose his irresistible arms. But the sword of his Janissaries could not defend him from the dagger of despair. A Serbian soldier started from the crowd of dead bodies, and Amurath was pierced in the belly with a mortal wound. The grandson of Othman was mild in his temper, modest in his apparel, and a lover of learning and virtue. But the Muslims were scandalized at his absence from public worship, and he was corrected by the firmness of the Mufti, who dared to reject his testimony in a civil cause. A mixture of servitude and freedom not unfrequent in Oriental history. The character of Bajazet, the son and successor of Amurath, is strongly expressed in his surname of Ildarim, or the Lightning. And he might glory in an epithet which was drawn from the fiery energy of his soul and the rapidity of his destructive march. In the 14 years of his reign, he incessantly moved at the head of his armies, from Bursa to Adrianople, from the Danube to the Euphrates. And though he strenuously labored for the propagation of the law, he invaded, with impartial ambition, the Christian and Mohammedan princes of Europe and Asia. From Angora to Amasya and Erzurum, the northern regions of Anatolia were reduced to his obedience. He stripped of their hereditary possessions his brother emirs of Germion and Karamania, and Aydin and Sarukan. And after the conquest of Iconium, the ancient kingdom of the Seljukians again revived in the Ottoman dynasty. Nor were the conquests of Bajazet less rapid or important in Europe. No sooner had he imposed a regular form of servitude on the Serbians and Bulgarians than he passed the Danube to seek new enemies and new subjects in the heart of Moldavia. Whatever yet adhered to the Greek Empire in Thrace, Macedonia, and Thessaly acknowledged a Turkish master. An obsequious bishop led him through the gates of Thermopylae into Greece. And we may observe, as a singular fact, that the widow of a Spanish chief who possessed the ancient seat of the Oracle of Delphi deserved his favor by the sacrifice of a beauteous daughter. The Turkish communication between Europe and Asia had been dangerous and doubtful, till he stationed at Gallipoli a fleet of galleys to command the Hellespont and intercept the Latin succors of Constantinople. While the monarch indulged his passions in a boundless range of injustice and cruelty, he imposed on his soldiers the most rigid laws of modesty and abstinence, and the harvest was peaceably reaped and sold within the precincts of his camp. Provoked by the loose and corrupt administration of justice, he collected in a house the judges and lawyers of his dominions, who expected that in a few moments the fire would be kindled to reduce them to ashes. His ministers trembled in silence, but an Ethiopian buffoon presumed to insinuate the true cause of the evil, and future venality was left without excuse by annexing an adequate salary to the office of Kadi. The humble title of emir was no longer suitable to the Ottoman greatness, and Bajazet condescended to accept a patent of sultan from the caliphs who served in Egypt under the yoke of the Mamelukes, a last and frivolous homage that was yielded by force to opinion, by the Turkish conquerors to the house of Abbas and the successors of the Arabian prophet. The ambition of the sultan was inflamed by the obligation of deserving this august title, and he turned his arms against the kingdom of Hungary, the perpetual theater of the Turkish victories and defeats. Sigismund, the Hungarian king, was the son and brother of the emperors of the West. His cause was that of Europe and the Church, and on the report of his danger, the bravest knights of France and Germany were eager to march under his standard and that of the cross. In the Battle of Nicopolis, Bajazet defeated a Confederate army of 100,000 Christians, who had proudly boasted that if the sky should fall, they could uphold it on their lances. The far greater part were slain or driven into the Danube, and Sigismund, escaping to Constantinople by the river and the Black Sea, returned after a long circuit to his exhausted kingdom. In the pride of victory, Bajazet threatened that he would besiege Buda, that he would subdue the adjacent countries of Germany and Italy, and that he would feed his horse with a bushel of oats on the altar of St. Peter at Rome. His progress was checked not by the miraculous interposition of the apostle, not by a crusade of the Christian powers, but by a long and painful fit of the gout. The disorders of the moral are sometimes corrected by those of the physical world, and an acrimonious humor falling on a single fiber of one man may prevent or suspend the misery of nations. Such is the general idea of the Hungarian War. but the disastrous adventure of the French has procured us some memorials which illustrate the victory and character of Bajazet. The Duke of Burgundy, sovereign of Flanders and uncle of Charles VI, yielded to the ardour of his son, John, Count of Nevers, and the fearless youth was accompanied by four princes, his cousins, and those of the French monarch. Their inexperience was guided by the Sire de Coucy, one of the best and oldest captains of Christendom. But the constable, admiral, and marshal of France commanded an army which did not exceed the number of 1,000 knights and squires. These splendid names were the source of presumption and the bane of discipline. So many might aspire to command that none were willing to obey. Their national spirit despised both their enemies and their allies, and in the persuasion that Bajazet would fly, or must fall, they began to compute how soon they should visit Constantinople and deliver the Holy Sepulchre. When their scouts announced the approach of the Turks, the gay and thoughtless youths were at table, already heated with wine. They instantly clasped their armour, mounted their horses, rode full speed to the vanguard, and resented as an affront the advice of Sigismund, which would have deprived them of the right and honour of the foremost attack. The Battle of Nicopolis would not have been lost if the French would have obeyed the prudence of the Hungarians. But it might have been gloriously won had the Hungarians imitated the valour of the French. They dispersed the first line, consisting of the troops of Asia, forced a rampart of stakes which had been planted against the cavalry, broke, after a bloody conflict, the Janissaries themselves, and were at length overwhelmed by the numerous squadrons that issued from the woods and charged on all sides this handful of intrepid warriors. In the speed and secrecy of his march, in the order and evolutions of the battle, his enemies felt and admired the military talents of Bajazet. They accuse his cruelty in the use of victory. After reserving the Count of Nevers and 24 lords, whose birth and riches were attested by his Latin interpreters, the remainder of the French captives who had survived the slaughter of the day were led before his throne, and as they refused to abjure their faith, were successively beheaded in his presence. The Sultan was exasperated by the loss of his bravest Janissaries, and if it be true that on the eve of the engagement the French had massacred their Turkish prisoners, they might impute to themselves the consequences of a just retaliation. A knight whose life had been spared was permitted to return to Paris that he might relate the deplorable tale, and solicit the ransom of the noble captives. In the meanwhile, the Count of Nevers, with the princes and barons of France, were dragged along in the marches of the Turkish camp, exposed as a grateful trophy to the Muslims of Europe and Asia, and strictly confined at Bursa, as often as Bajazet resided in his capital. The Sultan was pressed each day to expiate with their blood the blood of his martyrs, but he had pronounced that they should live, and either for mercy or destruction, his word was irrevocable. He was assured of their value and importance by the return of the messenger, and the gifts and intercessions of the kings of France and of Cyprus. Lusignan presented him with a gold salt cellar of curious workmanship, and of the price of 10,000 ducats. And Charles VI dispatched by the way of Hungary a cast of Norwegian hawks and 6 horseloads of scarlet cloth, of fine linen of Reims and of Arras tapestry, representing the battles of the great Alexander. After much delay, the effect of distance rather than of art, Bajazet agreed to accept a ransom of 200,000 ducats for the Count of Nevers and the surviving princes and barons. The Marshal Boucicault, a famous warrior, was of the number of the fortunate. But the Admiral of France had been slain in battle, and the Constable, with the Sire de Coucy, died in the prison of Bursa. This heavy demand, which was doubled by incidental costs, fell chiefly on the Duke of Burgundy, or rather on his Flemish subjects who were bound by the feudal laws to contribute for the knighthood and captivity of the eldest son of their lord. For the faithful discharge of the debt, some merchants of Genoa gave security to the amount of 5 times the sum, a lesson to those warlike times that commerce and credit are the links of the Society of Nations. It had been stipulated in the treaty that the French captives should swear never to bear arms against the person of their conqueror, but the ungenerous restraint was abolished by Bajazet himself. "I despise," said he to the heir of Burgundy, "thy oaths and thy arms. Thou art young, and mayest be ambitious of effacing the disgrace or misfortune of thy first chivalry. Assemble thy powers, proclaim thy design, and be assured that Bajazet will rejoice to meet thee a second time in a field of battle." Before their departure, they were indulged in the freedom and hospitality of the court of Boursa. The French princes admired the magnificence of the Ottoman, whose hunting and hawking equipage was composed of 7,000 huntsmen and 7,000 falconers. In their presence, and at his command, the belly of one of his chamberlains was cut open on a complaint against him for drinking the goat's milk of a poor woman. The strangers were astonished by this act of justice, but it was the justice of a sultan who disdains to balance the weight of evidence or to measure the degrees of guilt. After his enfranchisement from an oppressive guardian, John Palaeologus remained 36 years, the helpless and, as it should seem, the careless spectator of the public ruin. Love, or rather lust, was his only vigorous passion, and in the embraces of the wives and virgins of the city, the Turkish slave forgot the dishonor of the emperor of the Romans. Andronicus, his eldest son, had formed at Adrianople an intimate and guilty friendship with Salzes, the son of Amurath, and the two youths conspired against the authority and lives of their parents. The presence of Amurath in Europe soon discovered and dissipated their rash counsels, and after depriving Salzes of his sight, the Ottoman threatened his vassal with the treatment of an accomplice and an enemy unless he inflicted a similar punishment on his own son. Palaeologus trembled and obeyed, and a cruel precaution involved in the same sentence the childhood and innocence of John, the son of the criminal. But the operation was so mildly or so unskillfully performed that the one retained the sight of an eye, and the other was afflicted only with the infirmity of squinting. Thus excluded from the succession, the two princes were confined in the Tower of Anima, and the piety of Manuel, the second son of the reigning monarch, was rewarded with the gift of the imperial crown. But at the end of 2 years, the turbulence of the Latins and the levity of the Greeks produced a revolution, and the two emperors were buried in the tower from whence the two prisoners were exalted to the throne. Another period of 2 years afforded Palaeologus and Manuel the means of escape. It was contrived by the magic or subtlety of a monk, who was alternately named the Angel or the Devil. They fled to Scutari. Their adherents armed in their cause, and the two Byzantine factions displayed the ambition and animosity with which Caesar and Pompey had disputed the empire of the world. The Roman world was now contracted to a corner of Thrace, between the Propontis and the Black Sea, about 50 miles in length and 30 in breadth, a space of ground not more extensive than the lesser principalities of Germany or Italy, if the remains of Constantinople had not still represented the wealth and populousness of a kingdom. To restore the public peace, it was found necessary to divide this fragment of the empire, and while Palaeologus and Manuel were left in possession of the capital, almost all that lay without the walls was ceded to the blind princes, who fixed their residence at Rodosto and Celebria. In the tranquil slumber of royalty, the passions of John Palaeologus survived his reason and his strength. He deprived his favourite and heir of a blooming princess of Trebizond, and while the feeble emperor laboured to consummate his nuptials, Manuel, with 100 of the noblest Greeks, was sent on a peremptory summons to the Ottoman port. They served with honour in the wars of Bajazet, but a plan of fortifying Constantinople excited his jealousy. He threatened their lives. The new works were instantly demolished, and we shall bestow a praise, perhaps above the merit of Palaeologus, if we impute this last humiliation as the cause of his death. The earliest intelligence of that event was communicated to Manuel, who escaped with speed and secrecy from the palace of Bursa to the Byzantine throne. Bajazet affected a proud indifference at the loss of this valuable pledge, and while he pursued his conquests in Europe and Asia, he left the emperor to struggle with his blind cousin John of Celebria, who in 8 years of civil war asserted his right of primogeniture. At length, the ambition of the victorious sultan pointed to the conquest of Constantinople, but he listened to the advice of his vizier, who represented that such an enterprise might unite the powers of Christendom in a second and more formidable crusade. His epistle to the emperor was conceived in these words: "By the divine clemency, our invincible scimitar has reduced to our obedience almost all Asia, with many and large countries in Europe, excepting only the city of Constantinople. For beyond the walls thou hast nothing left. Resign that city, stipulate thy reward, or tremble for thyself and thy unhappy people at the consequences of a rash refusal." But his ambassadors were instructed to soften their tone, and to propose a treaty which was subscribed with submission and gratitude. A truce of 10 years was purchased by an annual tribute of 30,000 crowns of gold. The Greeks deplored the public toleration of the law of Mohammed, and Bajazet enjoyed the glory of establishing a Turkish cadi and founding a royal mosque in the metropolis of the Eastern Church. Yet this truce was soon violated by the restless sultan. In the cause of the Prince of Celebria, the lawful emperor, an army of Ottomans again threatened Constantinople, and in the distress of Manuel implored the protection of the King of France. His plaintive embassy obtained much pity and some relief, and the conduct of the succor was entrusted to the Marshal Boucicault, whose religious chivalry was inflamed by the desire of revenging his captivity on the infidels. He sailed with 4 ships of war from Egimort to the Hellespont, forced the passage, which was guarded by 17 Turkish galleys, landed at Constantinople a supply of 600 men-at-arms and 1,600 archers, and reviewed them in the adjacent plain, without condescending to number or array the multitude of Greeks. By his presence, the blockade was raised, both by sea and land. The flying squadrons of Bajazet were driven to a more respectful distance, and several castles in Europe and Asia were stormed by the emperor and the marshal, who fought with equal valor by each other's side. But the Ottomans soon returned with an increase of numbers, and the intrepid Boucicault, after a year's struggle, resolved to evacuate a country which could no longer afford either pay or provisions for his soldiers. The marshal offered to conduct Manuel to the French court, where he might solicit in person a supply of men and money, and advised, in the meanwhile, that to extinguish all domestic discord, he should leave his blind competitor on the throne. The proposal was embraced. The Prince of Celebria was introduced to the capital, and such was the public misery that the lot of the exile seemed more fortunate than that of the sovereign. Instead of applauding the success of his vassal, the Turkish sultan claimed the city as his own, and on the refusal of the Emperor John, Constantinople was more closely pressed by the calamities of war and famine. Against such an enemy, prayers and resistance were alike unavailing, and the savage would have devoured his prey if, in the fatal moment, he had not been overthrown by another savage stronger than himself. By the victory of Timur, or Tamerlane, the fall of Constantinople was delayed about 50 years, and this important, though accidental, service may justly introduce the life and character of the Mughal conqueror. Chapter 65. Elevation of Timur, or Tamerlane, to the throne of Samarkand. His conquests in Persia, Georgia, Tartary Russia, India, Syria, and Anatolia. His Turkish war. Defeat and captivity of Bajazet. Death of Timur. Civil war of the sons of Bajazet. Restoration of the Turkish monarchy by Muhammad I. Siege of Constantinople by Amurath II. The conquest and monarchy of the world was the first object of the ambition of Timur. To live in the memory and esteem of future ages was the second wish of his magnanimous spirit. All the civil and military transactions of his reign were diligently recorded in the journals of his secretaries. The authentic narrative was revised by the persons best informed of each particular transaction, and it is believed in the empire and family of Timur that the monarch himself composed the commentaries of his life and the institutions of his government. But these cares were ineffectual for the preservation of his fame, and these precious memorials in the Mughal or Persian language were concealed from the world, or at least from the knowledge of Europe. The nations which he vanquished exercised a base and impotent revenge, and ignorance has long repeated the tale of calumny which had disfigured the birth and character, the person, and even the name of Tamerlane. Yet his real merit would be enhanced rather than debased by the elevation of a peasant to the throne of Asia. Nor can his lameness be a theme of reproach, unless he had the weakness to blush at a natural or perhaps an honorable infirmity. In the eyes of the Mughals, who held the indefeasible succession of the house of Genghis, he was doubtless a rebel subject, yet he sprang from the noble tribe of Belas. His fifth ancestor, Karashah Nevian, had been the vizier of Zagatai, in his new realm of Transoxiana, and in the ascent of some generations, the branch of Timur is confounded, at least by the females, with the imperial stem. He was born 40 miles to the south of Samarkand in the village of Sebzar, in the fruitful territory of Kesh, of which his fathers were the hereditary chiefs, as well as of a Toman of 10,000 horse. His birth was cast on one of those periods of anarchy which announced the fall of the Asiatic dynasties and opened a new field to adventurous ambition. The Khans of Zagatai were extinct. The emirs aspired to independence, and their domestic feuds could only be suspended by the conquest and tyranny of the Khans of Kashgar, who, with an army of Getis, or Kalmucks, invaded the Transoxian kingdom. From the 12th year of his age, Timur had entered the field of action. In the 25th, he stood forth as the deliverer of his country, and the eyes and wishes of the people were turned towards a hero who suffered in their cause. The chiefs of the law and of the army had pledged their salvation to support him with their lives and fortunes, but in the hour of danger they were silent and afraid. And after waiting 7 days on the hills of Samarkand, he retreated to the desert with only 60 horsemen. The fugitives were overtaken by 1,000 Getis, whom he repulsed with incredible slaughter, and his enemies were forced to exclaim, "Timur is a wonderful man. Fortune and the divine favor are with him." But in this bloody action his own followers were reduced to 10, a number which was soon diminished by the desertion of 3 Carizmians. He wandered in the desert with his wife, 7 companions, and 4 horses, and 62 days was he plunged in a loathsome dungeon, from whence he escaped by his own courage and the remorse of the oppressor. After swimming the broad and rapid stream of the Jhun or Oxus, he led during some months the life of a vagrant and outlaw on the borders of the adjacent states. But his fame shone brighter in adversity. He learned to distinguish the friends of his person, the associates of his fortune, and to apply the various characters of men for their advantage, and above all for his own. On his return to his native country, Timur was successively joined by the parties of his confederates, who anxiously sought him in the desert. Nor can I refuse to describe in his pathetic simplicity one of their fortunate encounters. He presented himself as a guide to three chiefs who were at the head of 70 horse. "When their eyes fell upon me," says Timur, "they were overwhelmed with joy, and they alighted from their horses, and they came and kneeled, and they kissed my stirrup. And I also came down from my horse and took each of them in my arms, and I put my turban on the head of the first chief, and my girdle, rich in jewels and wrought with gold, I bound on the loins of the second, and the third I clothed in my own coat. And they wept, and I wept also. And the hour of prayer was arrived, and we prayed, and we mounted our horses and came to my dwelling, and I collected my people and made a feast." His trusty bands were soon increased by the bravest of the tribes. He led them against a superior foe, and after some vicissitudes of war, the Getes were finally driven from the kingdom of Transoxiana. He had done much for his own glory, but much remained to be done, much art to be exerted, and some blood to be spilt before he could teach his equals to obey him as their master. The birth and power of Emir Hussein compelled him to accept a vicious and unworthy colleague, whose sister was the best beloved of his wives. Their union was short and jealous, but the policy of Timur and their frequent quarrels exposed his rival to the reproach of injustice and perfidy, and after a final defeat, Hussein was slain by some sagacious friends who presumed for the last time to disobey the commands of their lord. At the age of 34, and in a general diet or kurultai, he was invested with imperial command. But he affected to revere the house of Genghis, and while the emir Timur reigned over Zagatai and the east, a nominal khan served as a private officer in the armies of his servant. A fertile kingdom, 500 miles in length and in breadth, might have satisfied the ambition of a subject. But Timur aspired to the dominion of the world, and before his death the crown of Zagatai was one of the 27 crowns which he had placed on his head. Without expatiating on the victories of 35 campaigns, without describing the lines of march which he repeatedly traced over the continent of Asia, I shall briefly represent his conquests in 1, Persia, 2, Tartary, and 3, India, and from thence proceed to the more interesting narrative of his Ottoman war. For every war, a motive of safety or revenge, of honor or zeal, of right or convenience may be readily found in the jurisprudence of conquerors. No sooner had Timur reunited to the patrimony of Zagatai the dependent countries of Karizmi and Kandahar than he turned his eyes towards the kingdoms of Iran or Persia. From the Oxus to the Tigris, that extensive country was left without a lawful sovereign since the death of Abu Sa'id, the last of the descendants of the great Holaku. Peace and justice had been banished from the land above 40 years, and the Mughal invader might seem to listen to the cries of an oppressed people. Their petty tyrants might have opposed him with confederate arms. They separately stood and successively fell, and the difference of their fate was only marked by the promptitude of submission or the obstinacy of resistance. Ibrahim, prince of Shirwan, or Albania, kissed the footstool of the imperial throne. His peace offerings of silks, horses, and jewels were composed, according to the Tatar fashion, each article of 9 pieces, but a critical spectator observed that there were only 8 slaves. "I myself am the 9th," replied Ibrahim, who was prepared for the remark. and his flattery was rewarded by the smile of Timur. Shah Mansur, prince of Fars, or the proper Persia, was one of the least powerful but most dangerous of his enemies. In a battle under the walls of Shiraz, he broke, with 3,000 or 4,000 soldiers, the Kul, or main body, of 30,000 horse, where the emperor fought in person. No more than 14 or 15 guards remained near the standard of Timur. He stood firm as a rock, and received on his helmet 2 weighty strokes of a scimitar. The Mughals rallied. The head of Mansur was thrown at his feet, and he declared his esteem of the valor of a foe by extirpating all the males of so intrepid a race. From Shiraz his troops advanced to the Persian Gulf, and the richness and weakness of Ormuz were displayed in an annual tribute of 600,000 dinars of gold. Baghdad was no longer the city of peace, the seat of the caliphs, but the noblest conquest of Hulaku could not be overlooked by his ambitious successor. The whole course of the Tigris and Euphrates, from the mouth to the sources of those rivers, was reduced to his obedience. He entered Edessa, and the Turkmens of the Black Sheep were chastised for the sacrilegious pillage of a caravan of Mecca. In the mountains of Georgia, the native Christians still braved the law and the sword of Muhammad. By 3 expeditions he obtained the merit of the Ghazi, or Holy War, and the prince of Tiflis became his proselyte and friend. A just retaliation might be urged for the invasion of Turkestan or the eastern Tartary. The dignity of Timur could not endure the impunity of the Getis. He passed the Sihun, subdued the kingdom of Kashgar, and marched 7 times into the heart of their country. His most distant camp was 2 months' journey, or 480 leagues to the northeast of Samarkand, and his emirs, who traversed the river Irtish, engraved in the forests of Siberia a rude memorial of their exploits. The conquest of Kipchak, or the Western Tartary, was founded on the double motive of aiding the distressed and chastising the ungrateful. Tukhtamish, a fugitive prince, was entertained and protected in his court. The ambassadors of Arus Khan were dismissed with a haughty denial, and followed on the same day by the armies of Zagatai. And their success established Tukhtamish in the Mughal Empire of the North. But after a reign of 10 years, the new Khan forgot the merits and the strength of his benefactor. The base usurper, as he deemed him, of the sacred rites of the House of Genghis. Through the gates of Derbent he entered Persia at the head of 90,000 horse. With the innumerable forces of Kipchak, Bulgaria, Circassia, and Russia, he passed the Sihun, burnt the palaces of Timur, and compelled him, amidst the winter snows, to contend for Samarkand and his life. After a mild expostulation and a glorious victory, the emperor resolved on revenge, and by the east and the west of the Caspian and the Volga, he twice invaded Kipchak with such mighty powers that 13 miles were measured from his right to his left wing. In a march of 5 months, they rarely beheld the footsteps of man, and their daily subsistence was often trusted to the fortune of the chase. At length the armies encountered each other, but the treachery of the standard-bearer, who in the heat of action reversed the imperial standard of Kipchak, determined the victory of the Zagatais. And Tukhtamish, I speak the language of the institutions, gave the tribe of Tushi to the wind of desolation. He fled to the Christian Duke of Lithuania, again returned to the banks of the Volga, and after 15 battles with a domestic rival, at last perished in the wilds of Siberia. The pursuit of a flying enemy carried Timur into the tributary provinces of Russia. A duke of the reigning family was made prisoner amidst the ruins of his capital, and Yelits, by the pride and ignorance of the Orientals, might easily be confounded with the genuine metropolis of the nation. Moscow trembled at the approach of the Tartar, and the resistance would have been feeble, since the hopes of the Russians were placed in a miraculous image of the Virgin, to whose protection they ascribed the casual and voluntary retreat of the conqueror. Ambition and prudence recalled him to the south. The desolate country was exhausted, and the Mughal soldiers were enriched with an immense spoil of precious furs, of linen of Antioch, and of ingots of gold and silver. On the banks of the Don, or Tanais, he received a humble deputation from the consuls and merchants of Egypt, Venice, Genoa, Catalonia, and Biscay, who occupied the commerce and city of Tana, or Azov, at the mouth of the river. They offered their gifts, admired his magnificence, and trusted his royal word. But the peaceful visit of an emir who explored the state of the magazines and harbor was speedily followed by the destructive presence of the Tartars. The city was reduced to ashes. The Muslims were pillaged and dismissed, but all the Christians who had not fled to their ships were condemned either to death or slavery. Revenge prompted him to burn the cities of Sarai and Astrakhan, the monuments of rising civilization, and his vanity proclaimed that he had penetrated to the region of perpetual daylight, a strange phenomenon which authorized his Mohammedan doctors to dispense with the obligation of evening prayer. When Timur first proposed to his princes and emirs the invasion of India or Hindustan, he was answered by a murmur of discontent. The rivers, and the mountains, and deserts, and the soldiers clad in armor, and the elephants, destroyers of men. But the displeasure of the emperor was more dreadful than all these terrors, and his superior reason was convinced that an enterprise of such tremendous aspect was safe and easy in the execution. He was informed by his spies of the weakness and anarchy of Hindustan. The Subahs of the provinces had erected the standard of rebellion, and the perpetual infancy of Sultan Mahmud was despised even in the harem of Delhi. The Mughal army moved in three great divisions, and Timur observes, with pleasure, that the 92 squadrons of 1,000 horse most fortunately corresponded with the 92 names or epithets of the Prophet Muhammad. Between the Jihun and the Indus, they crossed one of the ridges of mountains which are styled by the Arabian geographers the Stony Girdles of the Earth. The Highland robbers were subdued or extirpated, but great numbers of men and horses perished in the snow. The emperor himself was let down a precipice on a portable scaffold. The ropes were 150 cubits in length, and before he could reach the bottom, this dangerous operation was 5 times repeated. Timur crossed the Indus at the ordinary passage of Attock, and successively traversed in the footsteps of Alexander the Punjab, or 5 rivers that fall into the master stream. From Attock to Delhi, the high road measures no more than 600 miles. But the 2 conquerors deviated to the southeast, and the motive of Timur was to join his grandson, who had achieved by his command the conquest of Multan. On the eastern bank of the Hyphasis, on the edge of the desert, the Macedonian hero halted and wept. The Mughal entered the desert, reduced the fortress of Batmir, and stood in arms before the gates of Delhi, a great and flourishing city which had subsisted 3 centuries under the dominion of the Mohammedan kings. The siege, more especially of the castle, might have been a work of time, but he tempted by the appearance of weakness the Sultan Mahmud and his vizier to descend into the plain with 10,000 cuirassiers, 40,000 of his foot guards, and 120 elephants, whose tusks are said to have been armed with sharp and poisoned daggers. Against these monsters, or rather against the imagination of his troops, he condescended to use some extraordinary precautions of fire and a ditch, of iron spikes and a rampart of bucklers. But the event taught the Mughals to smile at their own fears, and as soon as these unwieldy animals were routed, the inferior species, the man of India, disappeared from the field. Timur made his triumphal entry into the capital of Hindustan, and admired, with a view to imitate, the architecture of the stately mosque. but the order or license of a general pillage and massacre polluted the festival of his victory. He resolved to purify his soldiers in the blood of the idolaters or gentoos, who still surpass in the proportion of 10 to 1 the numbers of the Muslims. In this pious design, he advanced 100 miles to the northeast of Delhi, passed the Ganges, fought several battles by land and water, and penetrated to the famous Rock of Kupili, the statue of the cow that seems to discharge the mighty river, whose source is far distant among the mountains of Tibet. His return was along the skirts of the northern hills, nor could this rapid campaign of 1 year satisfy the strange foresight of his emirs that their children, in a warm climate, would degenerate into a race of Hindus. It was on the banks of the Ganges that Timur was informed by his speedy messengers of the disturbances which had arisen on the confines of Georgia and Anatolia, of the revolt of the Christians, and the ambitious designs of the Sultan Bajazet. His vigor of mind and body was not impaired by 63 years, and innumerable fatigues, and after enjoying some tranquil months in the palace of Samarkand, he proclaimed a new expedition of 7 years into the western countries of Asia. To the soldiers who had served in the Indian War, he granted the choice of remaining at home or following their prince. But the troops of all the provinces and kingdoms of Persia were commanded to assemble at Isfahan and wait the arrival of the imperial standard. It was first directed against the Christians of Georgia, who were strong only in their rocks, their castles, and the winter season. But these obstacles were overcome by the zeal and perseverance of Timur. The rebels submitted to the tribute, or the Quran, and if both religions boasted of their martyrs, that name is more justly due to the Christian prisoners who were offered the choice of abjuration or death. On his descent from the hills, the emperor gave audience to the first ambassadors of Bajazet, and opened the hostile correspondence of complaints and menaces which fermented 2 years before the final explosion. Between two jealous and haughty neighbors, the motives of quarrel will seldom be wanting. The Mughal and Ottoman conquests now touched each other in the neighborhood of Erzurum and the Euphrates, nor had the doubtful limit been ascertained by time and treaty. Each of these ambitious monarchs might accuse his rival of violating his territory, of threatening his vassals, and protecting his rebels. And by the name of rebels each understood the fugitive princes, whose kingdoms he had usurped, and whose life or liberty he implacably pursued. The resemblance of character was still more dangerous than the opposition of interest, and in their victorious career Timur was impatient of an equal, and Bajazet was ignorant of a superior. The first epistle of the Mughal emperor must have provoked, instead of reconciling, the Turkish sultan, whose family and nation he affected to despise. Dost thou not know that the greatest part of Asia is subject to our arms and our laws, that our invincible forces extend from one sea to the other, that the potentates of the earth form a line before our gate, and that we have compelled fortune herself to watch over the prosperity of our empire? What is the foundation of thy insolence and folly? Thou hast fought some battles in the woods of Anatolia, contemptible trophies. Thou hast obtained some victories over the Christians of Europe. Thy sword was blessed by the apostle of God, and thy obedience to the precept of the Quran in waging war against the infidels is the sole consideration that prevents us from destroying thy country, the frontier, and bulwark of the Muslim world. Be wise in time. Reflect. Repent. And avert the thunder of our vengeance, which is yet suspended over thy head.